Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everyone. This is Ryan Tripp on the New Books Network's History Channel. I'm here to discuss today Andreas Galiashenka, his new book, John Rawls, The Path to a Theory of Justice. Andreas Galiashenka is the Assistant Professor of Political Science at Wake Forest University. Welcome, Professor Galiashenka.
Oh, thank you. It's my pleasure to be here.
So this book was published actually earlier this year by Harvard University Press. Again, it's John Rawls, The Path to a Theory of Justice. What prompted you to study John Rawls's political and philosophical visions in the 1971 A Theory of Justice, rather than writing a complete intellectual biography? For introductory purposes, please also provide a very brief overview of Rawls's process of achieving a tentative reflective equilibrium, including those far stages of the original position.
Well, for one thing, I find the theory of justice a very interesting work, especially its core idea that political philosophy should show citizens that they hold shared beliefs and values, even though they might not see these shared beliefs and values. And also that the major social problems can actually be addressed from the position of these shared beliefs and values. I think to the supporters of this vision, Rawls's book offers a hope to be worked for. And for critics, I think it's we can put it as an interesting misunderstanding, which should be studied further. So I think this core idea is very interesting and important. Philosophically, I also find in it a very appealing vision of how we defend or justify our political and ethical judgments. So Rawls argued that we want to arrive at the reflective equilibrium, which as he called, was a state of affairs in which our intuitive judgments about justice match the principles which are meant to explain these intuitive justice. So this twofold idea that, you know, we make judgments about justice and sometimes we don't know the reasons behind them, and then political philosophy helps us become clearer about these judgments, the reasons behind these judgments. I find this as a very human and a recognizable explanation. So that's my interest for enjoying the book itself. But in my own book, I also wanted to say something about the current liberal debate. I think that a historical work such as mine, by showing paths that have been taken, paths that have been left unexplored or not fully explored, I think historical works can have implications for today's political thought as well. So, for example, one of the main assumptions in the contemporary liberal debate is that to respect a person, we have to offer them reasons that they all can accept. So in this vision, respect is tied to autonomy, that to be truly self-governing, we have to be governed by laws that we all can accept. And so I think that my book at least reminds us that Rawls thought that this vision of agreement is more loose, as he called it, than we expect today. So that even though political philosophy can provide a way of ordering our principles, still some conflicts, some moral conflicts, it will fail to resolve. And then also as a historical work, I think it shows that Rawls's conception of respect was not tied to Kantian autonomy until the late 1960s. And so it's possible maybe to return to Rawls's earlier stage of work and try to address the contemporary liberal debate in its new terms. So in terms of historical work, I think we can have relevance to contemporary political debates as well. And then finally, maybe the more human answer as well is that I think that a complete biography of Rawls would take at least another book and several more years to complete. Rawls's archives, which I used to a great extent, they contain hundreds of notes, summaries, lectures, letters, books of Rawls's, and they provide really fascinating material, both into his thought and to some extent into his person as well. So to fully make use of them, I think you do need at least another book.
How did the 1939 to 1942 Princeton courses with Theodore Green and George Thomas, which included forays into Albrecht Ritschl's consummation historicism and Adolf von Arnack's experiential essentialism, how did this contribute to Rawls's initial non-foundational convergence of liberal Protestantism and neo-orthodoxy? Yeah.
So Rawls started his intellectual career as a religious person. He was brought up in a religious family, attended a religious school, but at Princeton, which he entered in 39, especially with the start of a Second World War, his religious sense heightened and became much more thought out. In the first years of his undergraduate career, he published two lengthy articles on a topic of religion, and his senior thesis, Meaning of Sin and Faith of 42, is also on the topic, obviously, of religion. But this was a big surprise to many interpreters of Rawls that, you know, the author of a vision which we could describe as secular liberalism started his career as a thoughtful religious person, and that there's this seemingly that gap between his early religious thought and the later work. And so it's an interesting question: what remains of Rawls's early religious thought and his later liberalism? And so I argue that what remains is this reliance on the lived experience, on a lived Christian experience in the early work, as well as the belief that this lived experience is actually shared. And so that relates to the later themes of reflective equilibrium and the shared beliefs of all persons. So in the early chapters of the book, I ask how Rawls adopted this strand of religion that justified its conceptual scheme by reference to the lived Christian experience. I think that a lot of commentators do not mention this influence, but it is core to Rawls's vision of philosophy. And I cite the influence of Rawls's teacher to answer this question, in particular George Thomas and Theodore Green, who worked in a very interesting time of American theology. That's when American theology wrestled with the inheritance of the historicism of Ritschl and von Harnack. And these latter argued in their own very different ways that Christianity should be understood by lived experience, not by dogmas, but by lived experience of the Christians, and that it has an essence. So once we set aside, as they called, the historical dross, we can see the essence of Christianity. And so Rawls's teachers, Thomas and Green, they also held these beliefs that writing that, for instance, to understand what God is, to see the picture of God, we need to look into the religious experience of Christians. Now, neo-orthodoxy, as you suggest, had a different conception of theology, and it rested on part in part on the claim that God is a person and God reveals himself to us. So typically, the neo-orthodox would claim that God revealed himself only once through Jesus, but Rawls's teachers used a more expansive notion of revelation, understood to include the more ordinary everyday experiences. And Rawls did too. So he believed that that God is a person, but at the same time that God reveals himself in the experiences of sin and grace, so the more ordinary life events. And so combining these two sets of beliefs, the Neo-Orthodox belief that God is a person and the more historicist explanation of Christianity as lawived experience, Rawls also understood theology as analysis of experience. I think it's very important. He opens the book, the thesis, the undergraduate thesis, by claiming that theology is an analysis of Christian experience, that our goal is to uncover a conceptual framework that explains this Christian experience. So I want to put emphasis on this, that even though Harnack and Ritschl may be neglected in stories about Rawls, they do have a role in showing why eventually Rawls's own philosophy stressed so much the Christian experience and a search for some commonality in it.
How and why did European Imago Dei notions of equitable personalism shape young Rawls's participatory political vision, sans merit impulses, and the shared experience touted in his 1942 undergraduate Princeton essay, Meeting of Sin and Faith? And what Pacific War events shifted his focus from Christians and non-Christians to the experiences of reasonable persons?
Right. So, as you say, Rawls's theology affected his political vision as well. Of course it did. In particular, Rawls believed that theology should discuss the proper relationships between persons. Just like God was a person, so humans, he believed, made in the image of God were also persons, and so they were expected to be treated as persons. I think this core, very broad claim remains with Rawls for the rest of his career, that when we talk about ethics or political philosophy, we are talking about understanding the proper relationships between persons in societies. Now, that said, Rawls's early work, early religious work, does not have many extensive discussions about what it means to treat a person as a person. He provides some guidelines, but there aren't that many concrete recommendations. For example, the first claim is that we should not treat people, other persons, as means. But again, here Rawls's thought is not very developed. He thinks that asking a person to bring us a cup of coffee is using that person as a means to satisfy our needs. So perhaps something like the distinction between using a person as means and using them as mere means is lacking in Rawls's early thinking. But the idea that we should not treat persons as just means is already there, and the question of what that would mean in a society as complex such as ours is already raised. And then second, Rawls's arguments seem to require a communal vision, these early arguments, that he thinks that each relationship with a different human being is a different relationship and valuable in its own right, and that somehow the political sphere should acknowledge the importance of these individual and distinct relationships. But again, he's not very clear of what that would mean in politics. Maybe it would mean listening to every person's opinions, involving them in a vote, all of them. Perhaps, but it's Rawls does not specify what that would mean in practice. Now, at the end of the Second World War, Rawls's thinking changed, as you say, and it's a big question of what happened and how. Thinking about his life, Rawls says that we might never know an answer to this question, but he cites three events that were influential in his abandoning of the theological concepts. And all of these events are, in one way or another, relate to God's role in this world and the effect of chance. So, for example, Rawls cites a case where his tent mate was selected to go on an exploratory mission, and Rawls was asked to donate blood. And the only difference between the treatment of the two persons was that Rawls's blood was a good fit for the donation, and his tentmate's was not. And because of this seemingly arbitrary difference, morally arbitrary difference, his tentmate died in exploratory mission. And so events such as these eventually led Rawls to think, I think, that we cannot see God as someone who actively intervenes in the world's affairs. So what's left of this theological vision. Other than the score of political vision that I mentioned, that we should treat people as persons, is that conception of philosophy, that we should treat philosophy or theology as analysis of experience and try to uncover these shared grounds. That's why I was insisting so much on Harnack, for instance, in my answer to your earlier question.
In Rawls's 1946 Princeton graduate essay on ethical theory, how did his idea of physicalism attempt to reconcile ethical theory with, one, logical positivism and axiomatic deduction, a la Kurt John Lucas, as well as, two, quote, normal observations of ethical utterances?
So one interesting aspect of working on Rawls's intellectual history was seeing how he reacted to the prevalent ideas of a time and the new emerging ideas of a time. I think it's really a testament to Rawls's thoughtfulness and openness as a philosopher that he not only considered these various ideas, but you can find as a historian various ways in which these ideas of his opponents, so to say, trickle down into his own thinking. And so Rawls's engagement with logical positivism is one such such story, I think. It is a very popular narrative about Rawls that he revived political philosophy in the 1950s by saving it from emotivism, which is a typical normative strand of logical positivism, I should say, which was the typical normative strand of logical positivism. And it is true that Rawls did argue against emotivism, but one of the interesting facts is that he actually drew on logical positivism and some of their ethical conceptions, in particular what he calls physicalism, to elaborate his own vision of ethics as science. So there's one thing to reject emotivism, but there's another thing to still borrow ideas of logical positivism and build a theory of one's own. And so Rawls's goal in this early essay of 1946, so the first year of his graduate school, again at Princeton, was to model ethics on science, and in particular on non-foundational logical positivist conception of science. And to do that, he drew on Carnap, Neurath, Popper in particular, and their aim to analyze what they called protocol statements or basic statements, and then arrive at axioms that explain these statements. I hope you can see how these themes reemerge. Instead of Christian lived experience, now we have basic statements or protocol statements, and instead of principles, we have axioms, which are meant to explain these protocol statements. And I think there are many interesting things in this story, other than trying to build our credence and ethics by way of comparing it to science. And that is this first the idea of basic statements. So if we take the idea of basic statements or protocol statements even more so, they were meant to be statements of something extremely non-contestable, such as, you know, I'm finishing the book, the book's conclusion on 3:45 p.m. on January 3rd, 2018. This was just a descriptive statement of what all normal scientific observers were meant to agree. And Rawls thought that we might try something like this in ethics. We take a basic ethical statement, and for him, those would be statements such as this is just or this is courageous when applied to particular situations, and then try to develop axioms, or rather principles, which would explain these basic statements. So I think that once we turn to post-World War II and Rawls's post-religious thinking, we see in this scientific vision of ethics at least two interesting things. The idea that to justify a theory, you have to reach a point of equilibrium in which these principles or axioms match the judgments that normal observers make. And then the expectation that there are some ethical judgments that are so basic that every normal ethical observer, which Rawls called a reasonable person, would agree on these statements. So I think these basic ideas, they last into a theory of justice, and they form the core of Rawls's argument therein.
How and why did the Kelsian pure theory of law allow Rawls to circumvent utterances as emotions, the conflation of utterances as emotions, in order to inquire into situational impulses for and Henry Sidgwick's Imperative Utilitarianism of Perspectives on Right and Wrong. Also, what were characteristics of a universal reasonable man and his judgments in Rawls's 1947 Remarks on Ethics and that subsequent Cornell dissertation?
I will start with the second part of your question about normal observers and reasonable persons, how they are defined. Well, in a scientific theory, normal observers have to be defined in uncontroversial terms, or at least as uncontroversial terms as possible, because otherwise you would have to explain why you're excluding certain scientists in this case from this category of normal scientists or normal observers. And the same way in ethical theory, if you only describe a certain proportion of the human population as normal observers or as reasonable persons, you would have to explain why the other part of the population is deemed to be unreasonable. And Rawls did not want to do that. He wanted to keep the definition of a reasonable person as universal as possible, so that he did not need to defend this definition against excluding many other persons which others would judge as reasonable. And so when you read the definition, it's really an uncontroversial one. For example, there are three main qualities which Rawls emphasizes in reasonable persons. So reasonable persons have the ability to understand and use the canons of evidence by which they justify their right to hold an opinion. Second, they have the knowledge of these canons. And three, they have the willingness to submit to judgments of these canons. So this simply the ability to understand the canons of evidence, knowledge of these canons, and then the willingness of these canons. It seems like this description applies to every human person, and that's what Rawls meant to do. Now, this gets more complicated. Rawls excludes Hegelians, for instance, as not exhibiting scientific temper, but that more complicated story should probably be left aside. Now, to the first part of your question, Rawls's first secular theory of ethical judgments, which he called imperative utilitarianism, was a very formalistic theory, and in that regard, it differs greatly from a theory of justice. A theory of justice gives us guidelines for organizing our society. It tells us, so to say, how to behave. Rawls's first ethical theory was an analysis of our reasons for making the ethical judgments. So when we say, you are courageous, Rawls would ask, why are we making this judgment? And he argued that we use these ethical judgments to encourage rare actions that the speaker thinks will lead to the greatest amount of good, and to discourage frequent actions that would diminish the amount of good. So for example, if we are in a context of war, praising someone as courageous is meant to encourage more such courageous actions which are necessary in a society. So it was an analysis of ethical judgments, but not what they imply, but rather into the reasons for which these judgments are made. So it was not a fully fledged ethical theory that we would see in the later stages of Rawls's life.
How and why did Cornell conversations about induction counterintuitively result in Rawls's search for intentional meaning and ethical utterances, detached from meaning holism and Wittgensteinian contexts, his belief in an objective factor among the agreements of reasonable persons, and his ensuing proposals for non-absurd ethical principles that transcended intentionality?
So this question alludes to a very interesting part of Rawls's intellectual development and to the second year of his graduate school, which he spent at Cornell University and studied with various Wittgensteinians, Max Black, or at least people influenced by Wittgenstein's ideas, such as Arthur Edward Murphy. And so there were various interesting changes in his thinking about scientific ethics. In particular, he turned away from what we just saw in my response to your earlier question about the reasons for which we make ethical statements into the actual intentional meaning of these statements. So in the case of justice, that would be statements about what justice actually implies for our actions or for our society. So that's a very important shift, which brings us much closer to a theory of justice. That said, in that period in 1947, even though Rawls did ask questions about what our ethical judgments lead us to believe and how they lead us to behave, he still restricted his inquiries to the most general subjects. He wanted to see which of our judgments are absurd and which are not. And this emerges from his interest in justifying ethics. That's where Wittgenstein's influence comes in. So Wittgenstein has argued that at some point our explanations of why we believe certain things come to a stop. And at that point, as Wittgenstein put it, persuasion starts to take place. And the same way, Rawls wanted to ask, at what point should we stop trying to justify our own views to the critics? And his answer in this year of 1947 was that we stop when the rejection of our principles would lead to an absurd way of life. And that was his interest in 1947, to see what core beliefs of ours, what core ethical principle of ours are so ingrained in our thought that their rejection would be absurd. And he emphasized two of these judgments, for example, that we should not condemn persons for being ill, or we should not treat unjust people as ill persons. So you can see how broad these initial explorations are. We're looking at the very basic ingrained beliefs, in this case, about moral responsibilities. These were not yet principles of justice, as we know for in a theory of justice. That said, I do still want to say that even though there were interesting and important changes in Rawls's philosophical vision, this notion of absurdity as a justifying force, he still continued to elaborate his scientific vision of ethics. So, for example, he developed the notion of an objective factor that resides in ethical situations, which you mentioned in your question. So Rawls asked, if it's really true that some principles are so ingrained in our thought that their rejection is absurd, why is it that we as human beings hold these principles of justice? What explains all of our holding these principles of justice? And his answer was at that point is objective factor of ethical situations. Just like in science, or as he put it, just as our common perceptions are caused by and controlled by an objective order of events, so we have some reason to think that there's a common objective moral fact which causes and controls our moral judgments. So I take the statement to be the ultimate reliance on his scientific vision, that now we have a analogy to observation and this positing of a common objective moral fact. That will disappear as Rawls revises his arguments in the later years.
After Rawls became a professor at Princeton, how and why did a 1950-51 reading group on the 1944 theory of games change his conceptions of personhood, his advocacy for equal rights claims, and life goals, as well as moral laws inherent in his idea of moral freedom with limited state interference?
So that's another chapter in Rawls's life. And as you can see, state in your question, it appeals to very different ideas. So now we're moving away from Wittgensteinians to game theory. And that too, this game theory too has an influence in the formulation of Rawls's ideas of moral and political philosophy. And in particular, we see in this time period the development of his conception of autonomy. Not yet a Kantian autonomy as independence of contingent circumstances, but more broadly a conception of autonomy as reliance on moral law. So the question then becomes, how did Rawls understand this conception of autonomy or this self-governance? And there are two parts of to this answer. First, we want to recall an earlier writing from 1946 when Rawls returned to Kantian ideas, in which he described the highest human freedom as obedience to the moral law. So if we as human beings want to be most free, we have to organize our life in such a way that it follows the moral law. So given that idea, when we come to the early 1950s, when Rawls studies game theory and discusses economic works, we see an addition to this idea of autonomy as ability to determine one's own conception of a good life. So if the Kantian autonomy refers to our ability to follow the moral law and the principles of justice that they imply, the economic ideas of game theory refer to one's choice of a good life. And here we find Rawls's arguments that individuals should be given a freedom to determine what they themselves deem to be as a good life. And so it's an interesting, I should mention that in the later years, these two visions of autonomy are combined into one common vision. So it's a our ability to determine what is a good life, as well as ability to follow the moral law and the principles of justice that requires. But at this point in the 1950s, Rawls's arguments still treat them as separate ones, not conflicting ones, but as separate visions of freedom. So why does Rawls think that one should have a right to determine one's own good? Well, he gives at least two reasons. One is he believes that there is no such thing as the highest good. So that even if we try to impose a certain way of life on a person, we cannot provide an argument to show that our chosen vision is the highest sort of good. And then second, even if we did know what the highest good was, if we tried to impose that good politically on persons, society would be, as he puts it, a game that no one wants to play, which means that politically, this would require such enforcement and violations of liberty that it would not be a society that we would desire. So these are two interesting reasons, realist reason as well, for not wanting to impose a specific way of life on persons. I think this should be interesting to critics of Rawls as well, to the realist critics of Rawls, who argue that Rawls ignores political institutions and the broad facts of life. At least in this case, when Rawls defends our freedom to choose the kind of life we want to live, Rawls definitely takes these strictures of life into consideration. So in his early years, the two parts of conception of autonomy are still stated separately, not linked, but in the later years, he would link them as one shared conception of autonomy.
On that note, how and why did these reconfigurations frame Rawls's idea of justice as fairness, as one's good in an interest-based political economy, premised on the entwinement of liberal politics with liberal economics? Also, how and why did the pure case experiment generate Rawls's principles of equality and institution-helmed functional inequality, or support thereof?
Right. So it's an interesting question of what kind of economic system would be required by the principles of justice that Rawls himself depends. And at least we can see from these early writings that it is an economic system in which one is allowed to, so to say, purchase what one desires. And I think the reasons behind this stricture are the same as the ones I mentioned in an answer to your earlier question, that namely the imposition of another system would require such violations of liberty that we cannot desire a system of that kind. That said, whenever Rawls talks about our choice of a conception of a good and our pursuit of that concept of that good life. He always talks about the limits of justice that are imposed on us. And I should have said that in an answer to your earlier question as well, that even though we can decide on a conception of a good and pursue it, we still have to do that within the limits of justice. So there are some limits to this pursuit. But as we'll see in the theory of justice, these limits are, at least Rawls attempts to expand these limits as far as possible. Now, the second part of your question about the pure case experiment, I think it refers to a very important conclusion, and that is that when we are comparing the various systems of social cooperation and various systems of justice, our criterion for evaluating them is equality and not some other standard. For instance, it's very typical of us to say, well, our current society is not just, but in comparison to what went before, we are much more advanced in this path towards justice. But according to Rawls, that's a wrong way of looking at systems of justice. What I just said may well be true, that we're far along. But when we are deciding between the societies that are the most just, our standard of evaluating them is always equality. So we start with completely equal treatment of persons economically and politically, and we stay there unless we can show that the system of social cooperation can be better than the initial equality. So in the later arguments, this would become known as the difference principle, that we are allowed to introduce inequalities in our society insofar as we can show that the least advantaged persons in that society are still better off in this unequal society than they would be in a society marked by complete political and economic equality. So I think this is a very important conclusion, which sets Rawls's arguments for the later years. But as a sort of a side note, I should add that this is the one of the beginnings of Rawls's many thought experiments. So as we discussed, Rawls's goal in political philosophy was to provide a principles of justice which would explain our judgments about justice. And one way to do that would be through the various historical analyses, which would be perhaps very interesting but more time consuming. Rawls's own solution would be to provide a thought experiment which would quickly clarify our intuitive ideas of justice. And so he tweaked his experiments for many years. And, you know, your earlier question was, how did Rawls himself arrive at this reflective equilibrium? And he did that through a good 20 years. He started out in the early 50s with this first version of experiment in which he established the baseline of equality. And then he tweaked various parts to arrive at the completed version of it, arguably by the late 50s or perhaps a little bit later. But this initial conclusion that we start with equality and we move from there on only if it improves everyone's condition, including those who are least well off, I think it's found already here, and it's very important for Rawls's later political vision.
By 1952, how and why did Stephen Toulmin's philosophy of ethics by example, rather than a inquiry into truth, as well as Rawls's constitutive rules for ethics and universal practices, help revamp justice, or his notion of justice, into bins of reason and logically loose institutional reconciliations of competing claims that A, would guide discussions, and B, would assess individual acts as justifiable?
Right. So when Rawls became instructor in Princeton, having finished his PhD, he attended a course of Geo Urmson, a philosopher from Oxford, and he talked to him as well. And this introduced the various Wittgensteinian ideas to a greater degree even than in 1947. So this, as you can see, this engagement with Wittgenstein, even though it starts as a as a more silent engagement, so to say, increases over Rawls's intellectual career and affects his visions of justice in a great degree. But in this case, these conversations with Urmson lead Rawls to read Toulmin's examination of the place of reason in ethics. And Rawls writes a review of the book, and it's a very influential work on Rawls's own theory, and it introduces several ideas which are crucial to Rawls's thinking in that time period. In particular, that we should understand ethical reasoning as practices or activities governed by rules. And Toulmin wanted to show that ethical reasoning itself is an activity governed by rules. That's, you know, in 1950, when this argument is made, this is a radical claim, not to us now anymore, because we clearly go by an assumption that ethical reasoning is governed by some rules, which allow us to say that's a good conclusion, that's it's not an appropriate conclusion to the argument. But at the time when emotivism was still prevalent, and its claim that ethical utterances are just expressions of emotions, Toulmin's claim that ethical reasoning is actually governed by rules, it's a practice governed by rules, it was a radical departure and a very interesting work. So it's not a surprise that Rawls rushes to review the book and leaves various kinds of notes on it and draws on it in his later writings. And so what was needed, according to Toulmin, to show that ethical reasoning is an activity governed by rules was, one, to find a criterion which or the function of ethical reasoning, and then to show how various rules that are implicit in our reasoning help us to arrive at that function or goal. And Toulmin himself argued that ethical reasoning had a goal of correlating the feelings and behavior of people in society in such a way that makes the fulfillment of everyone's aims and desires as great as possible. So again, we can see how people choose their conceptions of good life, and political philosophy, or in this case ethics, tries to make it possible for the variety of people to live out these good lives. And Rawls follows Toulmin in this thinking. He writes, reasoning is an activity. It's something that men do. And as an activity, it is governed by certain rules. Now, he adds that these rules are universal. As he puts it, the rulemaking body of ethical reasoning is everybody. We're not talking about ethical reasoning in the United States. We are talking about ethical reasoning in general. And as Rawls puts it, if there is such a thing as ethical reasoning, we'll find the same rules in the United States or any other part of the world. And he also keeps Toulmin's idea that the function of ethics is, well, it's a slightly a different version of it, is to solve disagreement. So I think that's where Rawls states for the first time very clearly that the goal of ethics is to provide these shared grounds which would then help us solve the various political disagreements that are prevalent in our society. Now, having understood this conception of ethics as ethical reasoning as an activity, Rawls also changed his account of principles of justice. So, as you say, he called them bins of reasons, which brings in a new idea to Rawls, and one that I did want to emphasize in my own book, that when Rawls provides guidance to our judgments, he does this with the cautionary notes that this guidance is still loose and that ethical principles are just bins of the various reasons that might be conflicting within them. So when we think about Rawls now, we think of him as an author of a theory of justice which states two principles. The principle which gives equal political liberty to us, or rather political liberties, as Rawls was later corrected, and then a principle that organizes our economic and social system to the advantage of a least well-off persons therein. And when you state it like this, I think I at least initially got the impression that we have all the rules we need for our political thinking. The principles are ordered, and that the first one always trumps the second one. And so there's that clarity. Beyond this, it seems like all problems would be solved. But as Rawls wants to remind us, that's not quite the case. That even the very first principle, that the fact that we're all granted equal political liberties, it contains, to use Rawls's language, bins of reasons. It contains all kinds of political liberties which can conflict with one another. And Rawls actually was led by H.L.A. Hart to correct his statement. Instead of saying equal political liberty, as he did in A Theory of Justice, he later on changed it into equal scheme of political liberties to emphasize the fact that there are different liberties that might be conflicting. So I want us, I want us to keep in mind that even though Rawls provides ordering to our judgments, it's not an ordering which omits all problems. We can achieve greater clarity with Rawls's principles, but we do not depart from the complexity of moral and political judgments, and even perhaps the messiness of the moral life in which we find ourselves.
I'll ask you to revisit and elaborate on those arguments at the end of the interview. But first, how and why did Wittgenstein's 1953 philosophical investigations, as well as studies by Jean Piaget, frame ideas in Rawls's 1958 twofold basis of justice? In your response, if possible, please address moral feelings based on, quote, normal, natural feelings, overlapping moral views, that idea of natural basis, and the self-sustaining reciprocity of justice as fairness.
So, having finished teaching as an instructor at Princeton, Rawls leaves in the early 50s to Oxford as a Fulbright scholar. And there, several interesting developments take place in his thinking. And, you know, by now you see it as a theme that in each of these periods of Rawls's intellectual life, we see him engaging with a different set of ideas. And I did want to emphasize this in the book to show how many traditions of thought Rawls engaged with, and so in that sense how interesting his intellectual life was, not just how open he was as a philosopher, but also just how interesting his story was. But so he goes to Oxford, and there he attends lectures of Elizabeth Anscombe, who teaches on Wittgenstein's philosophical investigations. So Anscombe is a translator, not just a friend and interlocutor of Wittgenstein, but also the translator of philosophical investigations. And then when he returns to the U.S., he starts working at Cornell as assistant professor, and he analyzes philosophical investigations to a great extent. He left an index for it as a multiple entries for a variety of topics in philosophical investigations. The book itself is summarized by topics, arguments are explained and thought about. It's an astounding amount of engagement just in the notes, not in a published work, but just in his own personal notes. And, you know, those notes on themselves are worth exploring in the archive if just for that topic. But there Rawls starts drawing on Wittgenstein's concept of the form of life, or the idea that the way we live is defined by certain concepts and practices that we take for granted, and we want to elaborate to make it explicit those concepts and practices. And so Rawls proposes to his students, he introduces these ideas first in the course, he proposes to his students to view morality, as he puts it, as a form of life, or at least as an aspect as a form of life. And this means, he thinks, that we should understand morality as a natural phenomenon, as a complex of thought, feeling, and action. So if we look at the morality, we should look at it not just in terms of beliefs, but also in terms of feelings and the actions to which both of these lead. And in particular, in these courses on moral psychology, Rawls asks how moral views, such as his own, are connected with the various moral feelings. And initially, these thoughts are really just explorations. And I find I personally find this period of Ross's life the most interesting and the most creative part of life, in part because he explores these ideas and he's open about this to his students. He says, let's try this out. Let's see where our thought leads. And so he looks at how moral views are connected to moral feelings. And to clarify these ideas, he distinguishes between natural feelings and moral feelings. So natural feelings are feelings that do not presuppose moral concepts. So joy, grief, anger, fear, love, these are the feelings that do not presuppose moral concepts. And moral feelings are those that do presuppose moral concepts, in particular those of justice. So and the feelings of guilt, regret, remorse are the first ones that Rawls would consider. And his argument is that these moral feelings develop out of natural feelings through just normal associations of human life. And so hopefully you can see the connection between natural feelings, moral feelings, and then the moral conceptions. In some way, these moral conceptions, the conceptions of justice, will be related to the natural feelings which mark us as normal human beings, so Rawls would say. And so Rawls explored these connections in his courses on moral philosophy and moral psychology, eventually arguing that a person without moral feelings would also have to be a person without natural feelings, which means that person would not be a normal being as we know human beings. So the first conclusion was that all of us have moral feelings and a morality. But his next question was whether this link between natural feelings and moral feelings excludes certain principles as moral principles. So he wanted to ask whether, for instance, whether Marxist principles of justice would be excluded by natural emotions. And his answer was no. All that natural feelings can do is to exclude very bizarre principles. For example, don't walk on the left side of a sidewalk. Rawls argued that it's very difficult to generate a sense of guilt for such an arbitrary rule. And so in that sense, moral principles like these cannot be connected to our natural feelings. But it would not exclude any important rival conception of justice, such as utilitarianism, Marxism, and so on. What natural feelings do help us realize, Rawls thought, was that our moralities actually would be very similar, that our moralities would overlap, as he put it, in their principles. Moralities resemble one another, he wrote, in their principles, and they have this sort of family likeness. And when he asks, why is it that moralities have this overlapping content? Why do they have this family likeness? His answer is natural feelings. That when we try to explain what it is to respond to another person as a person, and so we come back now to these themes from Rawls's early religious life. So when we try to treat another person as a person and not as an object, our natural feelings immediately come into the explanation of how we should behave. So joy, grief, anger, fear, love, and that's where moral feelings come in, guilt, regret, and remorse. So in that sense, what these explorations into natural feelings allowed Rawls to do was to at least give a reasonable answer as to why, if moralities were to overlap, and he did believe that they did overlap, why they would have this shared content. And that is because of a natural feeling. You also asked about reciprocity or the tendency to respond in kind and Jean Piaget's story in Rawls's intellectual life. And my brief answer is that while Rawls couldn't show that natural feelings exclude certain usual moral views as implausible, he did use moral psychology to argue that those moral views that rest on reciprocity as opposed to sympathy, which was in particular utilitarianism, were actually more stable in that it was, for example, very difficult to be sympathetic to the richest person in a society if you happen to be the poorest person. But if you live in a society based on reciprocity, at least you know that though you find yourself in the worst end of the society, that this conception of justice is preferable to the poorest person in that society. So in that sense, moral views that rested on reciprocity were psychologically more stable than other kinds of views.
How and why did logical positivist W.V.O. Quine's limited approach to meaning holism prompt Rawls to conclude that justification for a conception of justice is relative and, via fixed points or impartial considered judgments, should be critically compared to rival ideas of justice? Kind of already alluded a little bit to that. Also, how and why did this conclusion in turn shape Rawls's 1958 conception of the original position as mutually self-interested and his 1962 aims to achieve reflective equilibrium among ideas of liberty, equality, and the common good?
I should say something about meaning holism. So meaning holism is a thesis that a meaning of a concept is affected by the meaning of concepts connected to it. So, for example, if we take the concept of personhood, a conception of personhood in which God enters the picture is arguably, at least, a very different conception than, of personhood than the one in which reciprocity is treated as a core conceptual connection. So in that sense, I think that meaning holism presents a real problem for a position like Rawls's. Because according to meaning holism, if justice is connected to God, then it's difficult to see how it can overlap with a conception of justice that is connected, for example, to historical materialism of Marx. And Thomas Kuhn's historicism makes this point that in order to understand a certain, in our case, conception of justice, you have to elaborate all relevant concepts that are related to that, to the main concepts you're trying to explain. And once you do that, you'll see that that conception hangs together as a whole. And in that sense, it's very different from rival conceptions of justice. But when Rawls accepts meaning holism, he accepts not this radical version of it as we see in Thomas Kuhn, but that of his colleague Quine. And as I argue, Quine's meaning holism was a limited holism because he held on to the concept of observational statement. In the same way, when it came to ethics, Quine believed that human ethical principles have what he called a common core. And he believed that because he thought that the problems of human societies are, quote-unquote, bound to run to type. And so in that sense, while Rawls did acknowledge meaning holism, he didn't take it in the radical directions that more historicist thinkers such as Thomas Kuhn did and his more historicist critics of today would have liked him to take. But this accepting of meaning holism explains why Rawls thought that justification is, as you say, relative to other conceptions of justice. So in order for us to defend a conception of justice as fairness, we need to compare it to other typical conceptions of justice, such as utilitarianism or socialism. And to do that well, you want to lay them out, so to say. You want to lay out their main concepts, such as liberty, equality, the common good, and see how these main concepts apply to the social problems of the day. And then seeing how these concepts solve these problems, what they entail in the solutions to these problems, then we can say that one theory of justice is preferable to the other theory, to other theories of justice. And that's why I think that when interpreters claim that Rawls revived political philosophy in the 50s and 60s, that's too strong of a claim, but there's something to it. What they mean is that he brought political philosophy to these problems of the day, that his requirements that to justify a theory, you have to show how its main concepts apply to the problems of the day, required then to work out the details of these theories and brought political philosophy back from the more formalistic arguments about what an ethical judgment is to the question about various problems of justice in our society.
Can you explain Rawls's 1958 to 68 Harvard transition from utilitarian happy efficiency to his focus on Rousseau's general will and the least fortunate? Kantian and Kurt Baer's moral points of view on persons as the ultimate end, and Kantian revisions to the original person as mutual respect among rational moral persons who, under a veil of ignorance about their own contingent circumstances, create and then follow universal principles for the attainment of as many primary goods as possible, irrespective of Rawls's two ways, like, quote, socialist versus proprietary systems. Going kind of back full circle to the beginning here.
Right. And it is a very difficult question to answer. I still plan to look back into this question, and I hope others will join in as well. Because until 1960, Rawls described himself at least partly as a utilitarian. He thought that he was working within the utilitarian tradition. Obviously, he thought he was rejecting some claims of theirs, but he saw himself as elaborating the ideas that were found to that tradition. And so today, when we explain Rawls to anybody, we present the contrast between Rawls as a social contract theorist, as a contractarian, and contrast that with a utilitarian approach to political philosophy. So when we see a self-description like this, that I am working from within a utilitarian tradition, I think it's a difficult claim to believe, really astounding, but it is there. It's there in writing. And so it needs to be explained why in 1960 Rawls saw himself as working within utilitarianism, but by 1962 already became the person, so to say, as we know him. Now he started describing his work as that of the social contract tradition. And so my answer to that is twofold. Is that one, as we talked earlier, Rawls saw various conceptions of justice as not differing in a great many ways. He thought that there's a family likeness between different conceptions of justice, that they share some of the principles, and perhaps, as he wrote, they interpret these principles in a different way and add different weights to these principles. Now, from my point of view, that is already a big difference, but Rawls would describe this as still, these principles are exhibiting a family likeness, so we should treat them as, at least roughly similar. And so once you understand moral conceptions in that way, I think it's much easier to say, I'm starting to work from utilitarianism, and we'll try to see where this tradition leads me. But I might as well start from social contract theory, which is, by the way, what Rawls said. You see, you could start with a social contract theory, but given the important work that utilitarians, especially Sidgwick, have done, Rawls thought that there was value in trying to see where that philosophy would take us. And by 1962, I think he decides that the core problems of utilitarianism are too great. And in particular, this actually comes from his earlier writings, but I think the accumulation of these problems eventually lead Rawls to decide against working within utilitarianism, and that's a problem of slavery. Because in principle, utilitarianism can justify slavery. In practice, the argument goes that it would not. But from Rawls's thinking is that the problem is not even that utilitarianism can justify slavery, but that the very thought that we should even balance the interests of some, the least advantaged, namely slaves, and others, such as slave owners, is such an unacceptable idea that it disqualifies the theory as a whole. So that's the first part of my answer, that even though Rawls thought that moral conceptions should be understood as exhibiting family likeness, still some core problems within utilitarianism prevent him from exploring the tradition further. And the second part of the answer is the influence of Jean-Jacques Rousseau and his idea that the general will should spring from all of us and apply to all of us, as well as the claim that if general will is applied to a particular subject, it loses its rectitude. It becomes a partial view. And I think that eventually Rawls's core, Rousseau's core idea gives a guiding principle for Rawls's own original position, the thought experiment, in that what he tries to do from there on is to detach ourselves from the various particular circumstances which lead us astray. It makes us lose our rectitude, and so that's why we have the original position in the end, in which we as deciders do not know our race, our gender, our conception of the good, and so on. So maybe one thing to say is that now when we look back on that period, the kind of explanation I just gave might seem quite obvious, even if not fully satisfying. But when Rawls was writing himself in this in the late 50s and early 60s, I want to show that this transition from seeing himself as utilitarian and seeing himself as the social contract theories was a complicated one and not as obvious as we take it today.
So, a 1971 theory of justice. This question is going to sort of ask you to revisit your earlier comments and elaborate on them, perhaps. Why did Rawls hold that the first principle of justice in a theory of justice, this first principle of justice was a variety of distributive justice that rests on access to a system of liberties, especially for the least fortunate? Why did he hold that that first principle of justice should trump the second principle of justice, that is, fair equality of opportunity, especially when the two principles came into conflict?
Right, and I think you bring us to the problems which the looseness of the principles of justice lead us to, the fact that these principles are bins of reasons. But at the same time, you know, we see the kind of guidance which Rawls provides by giving us these two principles of justice. And so my short answer to your question is that he thought that this ordering of principles explain our intuitive judgments. But let me be more specific from here on. So the first principle of justice regulates the distribution of various political rights, the right to vote, freedom of speech, freedom to associate, and so on. And Rawls thought that these rights are so important that they cannot be sacrificed to economic and social rights, which are regulated by the second principle. So even if we could increase the wealth and income of the least advantaged persons in our society, we should not do so at the expense of taking away those persons' political rights. And that's where the explanation comes in. This is not only because political rights might be an important part of someone's conception of a good life. So you can imagine that your good life is a political life, and in this case, economic income is a far less important thing for you. But also because these rights are the best ways of protecting a person's conception of a good life, even if it's not a political life. So to speak about your practices and your practice, your main beliefs, such as religious beliefs, you want to make sure that in our society protects these rights. And since they are far more important than economic variables, that's why the first principle of political liberties is the most important one. It trumps the second principle. But even in the second principle, there is an ordering. So Rawls thought that equality of opportunity should trump the second part of a principle, the difference principle. So that even if we could show that taking away of equality of opportunity for some of us could improve the income of the least advantage, this shouldn't be done. So for instance, if you could see that if you could see that political that inequalities in our system, such as between genders, races, and ethnicity, could actually help us lead to greater economic wealth and income to the least advantaged persons, that still should not be done, because our wish to lead a certain life and to achieve a certain offices or positions that we might want is more important than economic income and wealth on its own. So even that, within a second principle, there's ordering, and the reason for that is the choice of a life that we want to lead. So in sum, though, as I said throughout this interview, we should view Ross's principles as bins of reasons which do not solve all kinds of problems. So even within the first principle of justice, there'd be problems between even between all of ours, freedom of speech, for instance. The principles do not solve all kinds of problems, but they do provide ordering to at least some of the main problems of our societies. And that's not all that we might want, perhaps, but it is something. And I think Rawls would have been satisfied with this much.
Fair and duly noted. I have one follow-up question. What's up for you? What's up for you next? Are you another project, or what's going on with you next? Maybe a vacation?
Well, Ross's thinking about justice made me interested in what we might call the borderline cases of justice, or margins of justice, and in particular animal rights, because recent, especially liberal political thought, has argued, actually drawing on Ross's ideas as well, that we should extend justice not only to humans but to non-humans as well. Ross himself did not think that. He thought that our treatment of animals should be encompassed by the virtues of compassion and humanity, but recent political thinkers have argued that justice should be extended to them as well. So that's my current interest. The same way the issue of immigration, the current topic of today, to see the various rights, and in this particular case, the right to one's culture, whether preservation of one's culture could ever be a good reason for excluding immigrants, or at least limiting the number of them. So all these questions, which I think lie at the margins of what justice is or what justice requires, have Rawls inspired these questions in me, and so I keep laboring on with his own thought in one way or another.
Well, thank you for being on the show today, Professor Galishanka.
Oh, thank you so much. I very much enjoyed this.
So the book is John Rawls, The Path to a Theory of Justice, out earlier this year by Harvard University Press. On behalf of Professor Galishanka and the New Books Network's History Channel, this is Ryan Tripps signing off. Please tune in next time.